Buongiorno tutti! Welcome to another international episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Aquariums. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. You know him as a novelist. You know him as a screenwriter. You know him as a lieutenant of Megaforce. He's Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going well. It's actually going very well.
Good.
I just got back from a film festival last week where I had a blast and been putting my new house together. We are recording for the first time in my new office, the battle station that is fully operational. Joe Lynch will be very sad to know that I am no longer reclining on a couch.
Yeah, he will be disappointed. He will find your lack of reclining disturbing. But the Dork Star is fully operational, and that is where we're recording this week. And it's a nice space to do that in. It's weird that we're not in the middle of everything in your house, and there's actually a door that will sequester us away from, you know, all the civilized people out there while we talk about our movies in here. So I'm a big fan of this setup in general. And what setup are we referring to? Well, the setup where we record Junk Food Cinema, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast, so good it just has to be fattening. And if you don't believe me, you can always go back to our back catalog on Blog Talk Radio as well as on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/ you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show,
I mean, you really like the show,
if you like the show more than Jamie Lee Curtis loves foreign languages, you can always support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/ Junk Food Cinema, where for as little as $1 an episode, you will get access to bonus content that no one else gets to hear.
Yes. You can.
This is the it's true. And I'm super excited, Cargill, because even though we've had episodes up every week, and even though part of the traveling that we've been doing, it literally at one point involved both of us traveling together, I feel like we haven't done this in ages. I feel like it has been a while since we've actually sat down and recorded Junk Food Cinema.
Well, it's been a long time since we've done it and not like in like on the run. Like we did the two-part episode with Joe Lynch, which had technical difficulties out the wazoo, so bad that even though you and I are sitting in the same room, it sounds like I'm the one phoning in. I think the last time we recorded was just sat down, me and you, to do this was in my old casa about 5 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So this is the beginning of the new era.
Yeah, this is season 6 or 12 or 38. I don't know where we are.
I really don't know where we are at this point. I think it's been a long fucking time.
I know we've been doing this podcast for 4 years, so we're going into our
maybe
fifth year. Maybe more than that. It's nebulous at this point, but I'm excited that we have a space and we can sit down and we can talk about these movies before one or both of us jets off to another city. It's getting pretty crazy. And very exciting is that we are recording this episode continuing on Summer of 88. And we just actually hosted a screening of this movie yesterday at the Alamo Drafthouse, a nearly sold out screening, which is surprising on a number of levels, but not surprising given the quality of the movie. And that movie is, of course, A Fish Called Wanda.
Otto is a man of many talents.
Hey, great fish.
Oh, a little squeeze of lemon, some tartar sauce.
Ken is a man of few words.
Tell him from me.
George is the man with the plan.
13 millions, my friends.
And Wanda.
Do you speak Italian?
Molto pericoloso.
Is the woman they love. They all set out to commit the perfect crime.
To 20 million.
To a job well done.
But it turned into something...
George moved the loot?
Less than perfect.
Disappointed!
So they turned to a lawyer named...
Archie Leach.
Leach.
George is going to tell him what the diamonds are.
With Wanda as the bait.
I want you to make love with me.
Pop.
Nothing.
He's really hooked.
I thought you weren't jealous.
I'm not. I don't believe in jealousy. It's for the weak.
How come a girl as bright as you could have a brother who's so...
Don't call me stupid.
I'm really, really sorry. I apologize unreservedly.
Are you totally deranged?
I'm afraid so, old chap.
John Cleese.
Will you leave immediately, please?
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Kiss me there.
Kevin Kline.
Put the other one up.
Michael Palin.
May I kiss you, Candy?
No, will you cut off?
A fish called Wanda. A smashing.
Oh, dear.
Comedy.
Yeah, this is a movie that I think we would be very remiss if we hadn't thrown. It's not necessarily our typical fodder for the podcast, but it would be one that we would have been remiss to leave off of our summer
list. I would beg to differ. I mean, it was very well regarded, but it's odd that it was very well regarded because this is a comedy that won an Academy Award for acting,
yeah,
which is something you just don't see in the modern era. You know, way back in the early days of Hollywood, when they were first kind of getting their head around what the Oscars were, that was something you regularly saw. But in this day and age, giving, you know, there are certain roles that you expect. It's like something Chiwetel Ejiofor told me about on when we were talking on the Doctor Strange set. He said that as an actor, you know what roles, when you're looking at them, are the ones that will get you nominations and the ones that won't. And that there is a formula to it. And this is the one that kind of breaks that formula. And so it's a well-regarded film, but it's still a heist movie and a zany comedy that includes bizarre dog death, surviving getting run over by a steamroller, and a lot of fucking absurdity in just the way that we love absurdity.
Can we, before we even get into the plot, can we talk about, you've already touched on something I wanted to mention, why the summer of 1988 was so big for steamrollers? This isn't even the first movie we've talked about in this series from this short collection of months that features someone surviving getting run over by a steamroller. And that, to me, is shocking. I mean, whoever was in charge of marketing for steamrollers was doing a great job in 1988 and needs to be commended.
Or maybe there just wasn't a lot of steamrolling to do, so they were offered at great rates.
it's a two-for-one deal, obviously. You know, if Roger Rabbit's going to do it, obviously A Fish Called Wanda. Two movies with animals in the title. I don't know. There's a lot of conspiracy theories I think you can weave out of that. But I think you're right. There's a lot about this movie that ticks off boxes on my list. I love farce. Of all comedy, my favorite type of comedy is farce. And I think it comes from, you know, in the brief window of time where I thought I wanted to be an actor and would attend, would tech, would, you know, appear in plays. Many of them were farcical comedies. And what I love about farcical comedies is they're juggling acts. There are so many different things that are up in the air at any given time. You have mistaken identity upon mistaken identity. You have characters who know more than other characters. I mean, we know everything. The audience is often omnipotent in a farce situation, but the characters themselves will vary greatly in what they know. And you have all of these sort of sub-schemes going on at the same time. You have a lot of doors opening and closing, a lot of rotating bedfellows, and that is all so well represented in A Fish Called Wanda.
I think you really hit an important point of farce is the omnipotence of the audience. And I think this is one of those films that's a great lesson in that, because the idea is that the audience knows what's going on and the people in the movie, in the production, don't necessarily know it. And as a result, you find that funny. Exactly. You know what the misunderstanding is, and the misunderstanding is hilarious. If we were not omnipotent, a lot of the stuff in this film, if we were just following along with the characters, would seem a lot darker and not nearly as funny.
Exactly. And I think it is really important as we go into this to talk about how the comedy and that exact point that you just made is what allows some really dark shit in this movie to play off as slapstick.
Oh yeah. This movie violates Brian's law three times. Three times they kill dogs.
Now, just to
and
be clear,
you love it.
Just to be clear, Brian's law is not the one where every time I come into your neighborhood as a new person in the neighborhood, I have to go door to door and let people know that I'm here. That's a different Brian's law.
That's completely different.
Okay. Yeah, because I used to call it like the non-fun trick-or-treating. But no, you're absolutely right. And the testament, I think, to how great this is at pulling off darkness by bringing a lot of slapstick to it is that one of the people attending the screening last night, my brother's girlfriend, is even more of a dog lover than I am. And it struck me halfway through the movie rolling, shit, I invited them to this screening, and three dogs get murdered. And I was like, oh, fuck, she's going to hate me forever. Like, I was really nervous, and I was kind of, like, looking over my shoulder. But every time it happened, both her and my brother were laughing. And we'll get into a little... We've really got to get into the plot, but... That is such a feather in the cap of this movie that it's able to dabble in really ridiculous over-the-top humor. It's able to dabble in some really black humor because it plays the motivations correctly, and it brings the absurdity of even the darkest moments to the front. And I think it's amazing how well this movie is constructed from start to finish. But let's talk a little bit about the names in this movie, because this is... unofficially a Monty Python film.
Yes. It's written by and starring, it's written by John Cleese.
Yes.
And starring John Cleese and Michael Palin.
Yes.
It's not really a Monty Python movie, but
I would, you know what, if I were programming a marathon at my own house of my favorite Monty Python movies, guess which one would end up on that slate of Fish Called Wanda, without a doubt. And then, of course, we have Jamie Lee Curtis, who in 1988 is still just...
She's radiant.
So, that's the perfect word for her.
She is radiant. She dominates this film, and she is probably... What's interesting is... You like her, and you want her to have a happy ending, and she's actually the most evil person in the movie. She is the most duplicitous, backstabbing, awful person that you just fall in love with as well. And this is a performance that hinges entirely on the charisma of the actress. And holy shit, does Jamie Lee Curtis pull it off. Lesser actresses, you would loathe this character. You would hate them, and you would hate the resolution of this movie. You'd want to see her go down in a really bad way, because really, she's the one backstabbing everybody.
It's very ironic that Jamie Lee Curtis, because you're right, Jamie Lee Curtis being the daughter of Janet Leigh, and at certain points in this movie, referencing Psycho, you have that feeling of siding with Norman Bates, where you want the car to go all the way down in the swamp. You want Jamie Lee Curtis to get away with the loot, even though you're right, she is absolutely the most duplicitous person in this film. She kisses every male lead in this film because that is her weapon of choice, is sexuality and the way she's able to easily manipulate these men. I mean, this all centers around a heist, and the heist is pulled off by Michael Palin, by Jamie Lee Curtis, by Thomas Georgeson playing George Thomerson in this movie, which I think is really funny. And, of course, the real reason you could argue that maybe this isn't a Monty Python movie, because the star of the film absolutely is Kevin Kline.
Who is billed as kind of both the comic relief and the real villain of the movie. Like, the movie makes him out to be the worst character, even though... He's really kind of not. I mean, he's up there, but I would argue that he's not nearly as bad as Jamie Lee Curtis.
And your argument, I think, would have a lot of validity behind it. But the quartet of them pull off a really daring heist of a diamond merchant, and they and what I love about the movie is this is the great thing about farce, is that it's not about the robbery, it's about everything that happens, all of the wacky circumstances that happen afterwards. So the robbery itself comes immediately, like probably 5 minutes into the movie, and is done within another 2 minutes.
Goes off without a hitch.
Yeah, it's the perfect robbery. And then they stash the loot, and Wanda has been posturing that Kevin Kline is her brother when really they're lovers, which at certain points in this movie... There was one point in this movie where she says something to him jokingly, like, has there ever been a better brother-sister team? And I turned to my wife and I said, yeah, Jamie and Cersei. But they're not actually siblings, although then, she does say to him.
Yeah. Even if you were my brother, I'd still want to fuck you.
Yeah. She just says that like it's a thing people say, and God love her for it. But her plan is to basically frame the organizer, George Thomerson, and make off with the loot. They know where the loot is stored. Unfortunately, they get the orchestrator, they get George arrested, and then find out that he's already moved the loot. So now they need him to figure out where the loot is kept. But George only trusts his right-hand man in this movie, Ken, played by Michael Palin. And I think this is one of the best performances in the movie. And that's saying something because everyone in this movie is operating at level 11. But Michael Palin in this movie is so kind and so... The stutter that they give him, they are kind of perpetrating the idea that he's a little dim-witted. But then when you watch him in action, he is such a competent thief. He's so good at, the planning. He's every aspect of the logistics that he's put in charge of goes off without a hitch. Like,
wait, what was the middle one again?
So many great running gags in this film. We're definitely going to talk about the running gags for sure. But I love Michael Palin in this movie. He is your heart bleeds for this guy, even though he's a member of this team of heisters, because they establish so simply, from a screenwriting perspective and from just from a cinematography perspective, I love the way that there's almost a television show opening to Fish Called Wanda. It feels like this week on Fish Called Wanda. And maybe it's just because you and I spent an inordinate amount of time at Denver Comic Con watching TV openings. But the opening to this movie, like the music and the way the character names or the actor names show up right as they're kind of posing and looking off, it feels very television. But in Ken's case, you see him building a model of the diamond merchant, and then he stands up and he is surrounded by no less than 6 posters for Stop Animal Cruelty, and then we see him feeding fish. You know everything you need to know about this character in a split second.
And the interesting thing is this is a classic technique. If you need to make a villain likable, the old Hollywood wisdom is give him a dog. You know, and it's not just give him a dog, but give him something to care about, give him something to love, and you'll instantly understand his humanity. And that's what's so interesting about Ken, is Ken loves animals. And that also plays into the raw comedy of what then happens through the rest of the movie. His love of animals and his sensitivity is his weakness and generates most of the comedy surrounding him. Because what's the stutter isn't really played for laughs except in one scene.
Right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It is a character trait. It's not a joke. The joke seems to be how everybody else reacts to the stutter. It's never like, can you believe that this bumbling guy, whatever, stutter. It's can you believe this asshole Kevin Klein is giving him shit for a stutter? Like, again, your heart kind of goes out to Ken, and they do such a great job of establishing Kevin Klein as the bastard, because Kevin Klein's character, Otto, is someone who used to work for the CIA, definitely has committed multiple murders.
He's worked for the CIA, but he's also a complete and utter fucking moron.
He's an utter moron with delusions of intelligence. He's constantly reading philosophy, even though he doesn't understand it, which is a really great moment in this movie where he says to Jamie Lee Curtis, like, apes don't read philosophy. She calls him an ape. And he says, apes don't read philosophy. And she says, yes, they do, Otto. They just don't understand it.
Yeah. Let's talk about Kevin Klein for a second. Because I think the thing of most interesting about Kevin Klein is he steals the movie from pythons, from Pythonians. Like, in what universe is anyone funnier than Michael Palin and John Cleese?
Yeah.
It's this one. And it's so, and yet at the same time, John Cleese wrote the movie. And you know that Palin had to help because Palin's also was one of the, you know, the main writers of Monty Python. And they allow it and they're down with it. And his performance is so delightfully over the top as Otto, that even small moments are fucking hilarious. He has a number of running gags and a number of bits that all meld together into a singularly memorable character that's unlike any that has ever been duplicated. Because the thing about him is, he's a complete fucking moron. But he's very good at what he actually does. When it comes to killing people and weapons, he's amazing. And you can definitely see his utility. And when you also, he's also good at anything crime-related. Mm-hmm. But everything outside of that, he's a fucking motard. Like, he's just a complete moron.
And he's completely driven by his ego and his infatuation with Wanda. He will literally just, she has him wrapped around her finger. And what I love about Kevin Klein, what I'm so jealous of Kevin Klein in this movie, is that as someone who, again, very briefly dabbled in acting, he is able to make all of the biggest choices available to him and still make it work. Every single moment, every reaction, he is shooting for the fucking moon and hitting it dead on. And that is what's great to watch about his performance, is he doesn't just get mad. He, you know, stares for a minute, and there's a great moment when they open the safe and the loot isn't in there, and he's just like, okay, all right, disappointed. And then when she says, like, we got to think, he just starts shooting the safe. She's like, what are you doing? And he goes, I'm thinking. Like, it's so good. Like, you watch him, you wait for the next thing he's going to do, be it a fuck up, be it a reaction. It doesn't matter, because Kevin Klein is so phenomenal and is chewing the scenery delicately. He's chewing the scenery and then picking it out with a toothpick also made of scenery.
My actual favorite moment of his is when there's a scene when Wanda is in the middle of making out with John Cleese, and in John Cleese's house, and he sneaks in and is immediately like doing this little dance of don't touch his dick.
Yeah.
And because he's had this whole big thing, he's like, you can seduce him, whatever, but I'm drawing the line, you cannot touch his dick. And he's like doing this little no dick dance that's just fucking hilarious.
Oh, the running gags with Kevin Klein in this movie, one of them being, you know, we mentioned this heist and George moving the loot while he's in before he goes to prison. He only trusts Ken with the knowledge of where it is, and he gives him the safe deposit box key, which Wanda, and only Wanda, sees Ken hide in the treasure chest of the fish tank, because Ken has a prized aquarium with prized fish in it, and he's in the fish tank, or in the treasure chest in the fish tank is where he hides the key. So the movie becomes Wanda takes the key. Wanda is trying to then figure out what the key goes to, and she realizes that if things get desperate for George in prison, he will probably turn over the loot to his lawyer, played by John Cleese. So now she's got to get close to John Cleese, and there's so many balls in the air. So she's several times in the throes of passion with John Cleese, and then out of nowhere, you will just see Kevin Klein's face pop up. It is like, it's not dissimilar from like Halloween and Michael Myers' face shows up outside the window. It's just every single time they're about to get romantic, it's like, boop, there's Kevin Klein popping up. And it's such a great, one of many great running gags that he has in this movie.
How come a girl as bright as you could have a brother who's so...
Don't call me stupid.
And the other one being, of course, that he thinks all British people are inferior scum, and he himself is a giant asshole, so he is routinely driving poorly and running into other people's cars.
Well, he's driving on the wrong side of the road.
Driving yes.
Like an American, and then is blaming them and yells,
asshole! As he's driving away, which is so
again,
good.
Another one of those triptychs like you were talking about, where it's the third, you know, the we see that twice before, and then the third time is the real payoff of that joke.
This movie has got its comedy mechanics down to a science, and one of the mechanics of great comedy is the rule of three. And if you're going to do a joke, you do it three times, because that's the perfect amount to let the audience know that it is a running gag without them getting tired of the joke.
The third time is always the funniest time it will happen.
Yes.
And then after that, it's declining
yes.
returns.
As it turns out. So yes, that is one of the great running gags he has in this movie. And so the key is in the Wanda takes the key. She's trying to get close to the lawyer to figure out if George is going to give up the loot. And if so, where is he hiding it? All of this is kind of going on, and subplot after subplot, and people stabbing each other back. One of the subplots of this movie is that there was an eyewitness during the robbery, this old woman with three... I'm sorry, Adam Green.
Yorkies.
But they are Yorkies. I feel like Adam Green can't watch this movie. I feel like in the same way I can never watch the It remake again or Sophie's Choice because of Dad Trigger, Adam Green is not going to be able to watch this movie because of Yorkie Trigger, because this woman who Ken is then assigned to rub out, Ken, the sweet animal lover of this movie, keeps accidentally killing her dogs instead of her.
In the most violent ways.
In the most horrible violent ways, like, that in the hands of anyone else, this would have really been a line in the sand moment for me. But the thing that saves it that we've kind of touched on already is that Ken himself is so beside himself with grief every time it happens that it allows you as the audience to laugh at it. And these dogs are not meeting natural ends. Like,
no.
One gets basically murdered by a bigger, meaner dog. One gets run over by a car, and one gets flattened by a giant piece of cement. So, yeah, like, really horrible if you've ever owned a dog or loved a dog.
And with a little brutality, too. Like, we see the dog get picked up by the other dog. We see the flattened dog that was flattened by the car. We see this blood puddle, like, coming out from under the cement block. Like, this movie goes to 11 in that regard.
Like, and apparently they were going to go further originally. They actually had, like, entrails in a couple of the kills, and test audiences were not keen on that. And I think by pulling that back, they found the perfect level, like as far as they can push it and still keep the audience on the side of the movie.
It is very Wile E. Coyote.
Yes. Like you're kind of expecting that middle dog to like reinflate and go on her way like a Tex Avery cartoon. So I think you're absolutely right on that. Throughout this movie, they just kind of keep ping-ponging back and forth between Jamie Lee Curtis trying to get close to John Cleese, Kevin Kline getting in the way of the two of them getting closer, and then Ken trying to kill an old lady and not being wildly successful at it. And then, of course, when things start to unravel and a lot of curtains are being pulled back, one of the funniest scenes in this movie is when Kevin Kline realizes that all of a sudden, Ken does know where the diamonds are stashed and begins to interrogate him. And he knows the only way he can really get to Ken is by eating the fish in his fish tank one by one. And it's such a great, ridiculous scene because he's also sticking French fries up Ken's nose every time he gets a question about Nietzsche wrong. And just like eating these fish that apparently were made of gelatin for the production, but I mean, he really is just swallowing these fish one at a time. And it's so absurd and so perfectly in keeping with everything that's been set up by this movie thus far. And we just watch him interrogate Ken by swallowing his fish one by one.
And I'm pretty certain every joke in this movie really works still, like, which is surprising. There's a couple moments where it's kind of like, oh, that's very 80s. Like, they have the other F word that shows up at one
there,
point.
There is a little bit of gay panic in this movie. And
which is very enough, which is very much in the 80s.
It is, but what's weird is that the character exhibiting the gay panic is Ken, who is, like, the least dickish character in this whole movie.
Well, I don't really know that element, like, what you're talking about is part of the gay panic. Like,
oh, it absolutely is. Because, okay, so there's an element where Kevin Kline realizes that Ken's getting close to the truth that he and Wanda aren't brother and sister. And the way he distracts Ken from that is to pretend to be gay and pretend to be interested in him. And Ken's reaction to that is pretty like, oh my God, stay away. In fact, at one point he says something to the effect of, Kevin Kline tells him like, I kill people all the time. Like, you know, killing people isn't right. And Ken says it's better than buggering people. So it is
that's a line that I missed.
Yeah. So there definitely is some panic from Ken.
The thing is in the rest of that scene, I read that and have always read that is the fact that Otto is being very sexually aggressive. Like it strikes me that he has nothing wrong with with him being gay, but the whole him trying to kiss him and cornering him in the corner and being very Pepe Le Pew about it is what really is making Ken uncomfortable. Like it's, but I guess the better than buggering people. Yeah, no, somehow I missed that line. That's a line that, that's not appropriate.
Well, he says it with a stutter. So I think it's very easy to miss, but it is pretty funny watching Kevin Kline, like just, because he knows that he's just freaking Ken out and say things like, I love to watch your ass as you walk away. No one touching me's mine. Like, at the top of his lungs so everyone can hear it. It's pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, and in that scene, again, Kline is, like, the way Kline flips and the way he puts on that that sexual aggression really does kind of flip that scene and make that whole thing make sense in terms of keeping the secret quiet. And then, of course, Ken goes back and like drops the bomb on Jamie Lee Curtis, and Jamie Lee Curtis just walks right into it because she's an accomplished liar. And it's like, yeah, no, we pretty much figured out you'd find out eventually.
Well, what was great is he says to her, Ken tried to kiss me, and her response is perfect. She says, I thought he might.
Yeah.
And it's not, I know he's gay. It's that's a pretty good tactic to use to throw you, because she and Kevin Kline are very much alike in that they're both accomplished liars. Well, he's not good at lying, but he will lie at the drop of a hat. There's a great moment where
he tells a terrible lie about the CIA.
He tells a terrible lie about the CIA to John Cleese's wife, Wendy. And she's like, my father was in the special services, and there's no way that you would go around telling the neighborhood if you were debriefing a KGB defector in a safe house. And this is my favorite part about Kevin Kline's character, is the insecurity about his intelligence. Because it's like, anytime anyone calls him stupid, that's another running gag in this movie. Don't ever call me stupid. And John Cleese's wife, Wendy, is the only one who ever doubles down on that, because she says, well, why on earth not? And then he just goes off on this rant like, you English think you're so superior. And it's like your uncle's favorite fucking chestnut of, you know where you'd be without the US of A? You'd be speaking German right now. It's like, yeah, I think I've heard this at a couple of family reunions. This whole, like, if it weren't for us, yeah, they're speaking German. Okay, great. Have another PBR. But he's so great in these moments where the veneer cracks and the real Ken comes out, and he's just fucking...
Ken or Otto?
Oh, I'm sorry. The real Otto comes out, and he is just fucking furious. And you realize the more he rails, he actually is a total fucking moron.
Yeah, he's a tool. He's a tool, which is why you hate him by the end. Despite the fact that he's not quite as duplicitous as Jamie Lee Curtis.
You no, still but he is
hate him more because he is stupid and he is arrogant about his intelligence at the same time. And there's so many layers to Otto that it's very easy to see in retrospect, watching it, why it was not only nominated but won Kevin Kline an Oscar.
Yeah, I mean, every moment, whether he's speaking or not, I mean, your eye is immediately drawn to him because you're wondering what is real. I mean, there's a great, like, miniature moment when he and Jamie Lee Curtis look like they're about to have sex, and then Ken comes into the apartment and they're in the next room, and they roll off the bed together. And within seconds, when they cut back to Jamie Lee Curtis looking around the corner, they cut back again to the room, and he's already back up on his feet and got the silencer on his gun. Like, in the span of about 30 seconds, he is just ready to kill. And little moments like that, little character beats where he is just ridiculous and over the top, but so committed to this character, you're right. It is no surprise whatsoever that he won that Oscar. It is surprising, however, that it's not only the only Oscar he's ever won, it's the only one he's ever been nominated for in a farcical comedy. It's kind of insane. I do like another running theme of this movie. There's a lot of fun with names that they have in this movie, kind of behind the scenes jokes. One of them I've already mentioned is that the character of George Thomason is played by an actor named Tom Georgeson. So they literally just flipped it. John Cleese's character in this movie is named Archie Leach. This is something I didn't know. Apparently, that's Cary Grant's real name, so that's why they chose that. At one point, I think they refer to Jamie Lee Curtis's character as Wanda Schwartz. Let me rephrase. On the call sheets, Jamie Lee Curtis was listed as Jamie Lee Schwartz because John Cleese found it amusing that Tony Curtis's real name was Bernard Schwartz. So apparently he's just fucking around with him. At one point, Kevin Kline says to George, like, who squealed? Was it Kevin Delaney? Do you want me to rub him out? That's Kevin Kline's real name, is Kevin Delaney. So there's just all these little things, like, that really, like, you wouldn't know unless you kind of, like, knew the behind-the-scenes stuff, but they're doing it all throughout the movie, and it's just little touches like that, like, that let you know they were having a blast making this movie.
Well, it's very, I mean, it's, John Cleese wrote it.
Yes.
And keep in mind that John Cleese, along with several of the other Pythonians, are amongst, like, those smartest people in the world type people. They're a lot like Brian May, who everybody knows him as the guitarist, the lead guitarist of Queen, but he's also a practicing astrophysicist. Like, that's, you know, these guys are all smart. All of their comedy is layered. It's informed by history, you know, informed by education. They're very well-educated men. And this is a great example of that. This makes me mad that we didn't get a lot more John Cleese written movies. And I don't understand why there haven't been tons of John Cleese movies.
He has said several times that this was, his favorite movie that he's done, which I'm not at all surprised by. It's so sharply written. Like, and we did a whole month on heist movies. Heist movies require special mechanics and a special understanding of that genre and very, very steady hands. And I feel like when you do a heist comedy, and when you do a heist comedy that is entirely farcical with over-the-top characters and equal parts slapstick and dark humor, again, just juggling so many things at once, you really need an accomplished writer at the helm. And I feel like that's the brilliance of this script, is it keeps all of those plates spinning without anything falling down, without anything feeling lost in the shuffle, without any stumbles along the way. Like, I love this movie start to finish, and I've watched it a lot kind of prepping for our show and our screening, and I've liked it more every time I've watched it.
Yeah, and I think the simplicity of the story is what really drives it, because it's really about these characters interacting with each other and backstabbing each other. And really, the leader of it, George, doesn't trust anybody, but he's also the most trustworthy of the gang.
Yeah.
Like, he means well, but when he does get backstabbed, he's already dealt with it. He's already way ahead of the game. But it's very interesting to watch all of these characters kind of play this chess game with each other of trying to score the loot. And the way it finally plays out at the end is pretty fucking satisfying and pretty interesting.
I feel like if there is one misstep in casting in this movie, the part of George probably should have gone to Bernie. Weekend at Bernie's, and I'm blanking on his name. But the actor who played Bernie from Weekend at Bernie's, who was such a quintessential asshole in 80s movies, kind of all the way around. He was just really good at playing assholes. And of course now, there are people screaming at me right now on Twitter. I promise I will figure out who that... Terry Kaiser. I feel like Terry Kaiser could have easily played the part of George, and it would have been... That would have been a lot of fucking fun. I would have enjoyed that. There's just something about the actor actually playing George that screamed Terry Kaiser to me. He was very Kaiser-esque. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. But yeah, like, as this progresses, John Cleese starts to realize a couple of things. But the one thing we do have to say for Kevin Kline that he does have over Jamie Lee Curtis in this movie is that she cannot resist foreign language. She is so aroused by it that anytime Otto starts speaking Italian, and a lot of it is just nonsense Italian where he's just listing...
Well, I mean, this is a very junk food cinema movie in which he's literally just naming types of Italian foods.
Yes, absolutely.
By the way, we decided to celebrate tonight, this episode, by eating wonderful delivery Italian food.
That's true. And as you were naming all the dishes that you ordered, I definitely got an erection. So I guess I can understand the impulse. But yeah, he says, he'll say things like...
You just had to really make me uncomfortable there for a minute.
Well, we're in a smaller room now, so I'm closer to you. So I thought it only appropriate to talk about my erection. He does say things like Benito Mussolini and Gorgonzola, and there are times...
Mozzarella.
What does he say? Un'salata verde con fettuccine. And it's like you're reciting a menu. You're not speaking Italian. But at one point, there's a point where he's seducing her, and she's finally giving in, and they're about to have sex. And when she takes her shirt off, he says something that translated actually means... there are the two glorious domes of the Cathedral of Milan. So he's actually talking about her breasts. But you wouldn't know it because the movie is so good at just convincing you that he's speaking gibberish. And then, of course, there's a great moment later where she's with Archie and he's like, yeah, I can speak Italian, but I prefer to speak Russian. And he starts just reciting this poem. And she is literally just humping a railing from the stairs. Like, just, she cannot believe how aroused she is. So it's this interesting sort of, like, I don't want to say character flaw, but definitely a weakness that she has, is she just cannot resist anyone speaking foreign languages. And Kevin Kline uses that to his advantage, because she is stringing him along, but, you know, God love her, she can't resist it when he starts singing Volare. And there's a great sex scene in this movie where he's just... It, again, I'm gonna invoke Tex Avery, because it is like watching that wolf that always... The Tex Avery wolf who would always just react to women finally getting to fuck a woman in real life is what it looks... It's a fucking cartoon just hopping up and down and singing Volare, and then his orgasm face... Apparently, Jamie Lee Curtis had to bury her face in the pillows to keep from laughing. It's too hard, because he makes this, like, cross-eyed, like, complete mugging spit take of a, I've just come! And it's fucking fantastic. So many great moments with Kevin Kline in this movie. Also, we should have warned you going in that this movie might be a little too funny. In fact, this movie might be dangerously funny.
How so, Brian?
I'm glad you asked, Cargill. Apparently, A Fish Called Wanda has killed a man. And I can't...
Accidentally.
Accidentally. And allegedly, I want to say, because...
Allegedly.
This is, of course, on the IMDb, so take it with the giantest of grains of salt. But they list the name of the gentleman, a Danish man named Ole Benson, who was a Danish audiologist, laughed himself to death during the scene where Ken gets the French fries up his nose. They said his heart rate climbed to between 250 and 500 beats per minute, and he eventually succumbed to cardiac arrest.
So are you telling me that this movie killed three Yorkies and a Great Dane?
Damn it. Damn, that's good. Did you write that down prior? That's good.
No, I channeled my inner Brian.
Wow.
I made you jealous.
Yeah, because it feels like I was building toward that exact joke, and I did not think of that exact joke. That's remarkable. I tip my hat to you. But yes, so be forewarned before you go into this film. It may be dangerously funny. Yeah, and this all builds toward the climax at Heathrow Airport. That involves a lot of different comedic elements going on. We have Ken, who is just tripping and falling all the way down baggage claim. We have Archie, who is, you know, making the big, like, run to the airport to get the girl back. And of course, we have Kevin Kline, who's convinced that he's 2 minutes away from winning the day. And everything that can go wrong will. And the great moment where Kevin Kline makes John Cleese climb into an oil barrel, and he's about to shoot him, and then John Cleese looks up and sees Ken driving an Austin Powers speed steamroller. Like, it's that joke from Austin Powers.
Yeah, it's the joke from Austin Powers, except that it works differently because he's stuck in cement.
Right, right.
And it's this very Looney Tunes moment that is just perfect and just keeps going on. And then, of course, has my favorite quote from the entire movie, you know, my favorite gag.
Revenge! I love the tactics that Kevin Kline uses. First, he doesn't know he's stuck in cement, so he's just like, what are you going to do? How are you possibly going to catch me? And then he realizes he's stuck in cement, so he tries to shoot Ken. And then that doesn't work, and then he tries to bargain with Ken. And then that doesn't work, and then he tells Ken he doesn't have the guts. And then that doesn't work, and then he tries to apologize for eating the fish. And it's just, the fact that steamroller is moving so slowly gives us ample time to work through these weird seven stages of grief that Kevin Kline's character is kind of powering through, culminating into him getting completely run over by a steamroller, which, again, would be super gruesome, a way to die, except that he doesn't actually die. So the movie, again, is able to brush up against the darkest of comedy and still be a farce. And I think that is so masterful. I can't think of another movie that does it as well, that really just gets to the edge of being, because I would not call A Fish Called Wanda a dark comedy, but it definitely pushes that envelope a few times.
Yeah, several times. But no, it's pure farce, and it's pure farce that at moments is entirely Pythonian, even though the tone isn't. Because the one thing that all of the Monty Python films have in common is they're all truly absurd.
Like, oh, for sure.
Every single Python film is an exercise in absurdity. You're never supposed to take the movie at face value, whereas here you do. But here at the end of the movie just doesn't give a shit in the last 3 seconds, where it just starts listing off all the things that happen to everybody that makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, it becomes like the end of Animal House.
Yeah, well, it's a parody of the end of Animal House, where it's, they're like, you know, what happens to them? Oh, they have 19 kids and found a leper colony. And Otto goes down to South America and becomes the Minister of Justice. Like, it's
we need to talk about that, because I started thinking about this, and this movie takes place, you know, 1987, 1988. Lethal Weapon 2 is 1989. Now I'm wondering if Otto might be at that consulate in Lethal Weapon 2, the South African consulate. Would he also have diplomatic immunity? And is it possible that one of the biggest criminals of apartheid is in fact Otto? Like, there's,
no, because he went to South America, not South Africa.
I thought it was, no, he goes to South Africa. John Cleese and Jamie Lee Curtis go to South America. The joke is that Otto goes to
South Africa
and becomes Minister of Justice, because it would make sense that an asshole like that at the time during apartheid, like, it is a really like drive-by burn on apartheid in this movie that is otherwise a complete farce. But it just made me, it started getting like a headcanon going, where it's like, I wonder if Otto then, if he is the Minister of Justice, would have taken up a residence at the consulate, and would he have crossed paths with Riggs and Murtaugh, which, complete sidebar for just a second.
Sidebar!
I watched those Lethal Weapon movies backwards recently. I started with 4, and then I watched 3, and then I watched 2, and then I watched the first one. I don't know why.
So they would get better as they go along?
Well, it's actually about a guy who gets crazier as the franchise, crazier and more suicidal as the franchise goes on. But what I found interesting is that in every single Lethal Weapon movie, every bad guy is so afraid of cops. It is something you don't see a lot in action movies, where they must have no faith whatsoever in their diabolical scheme, because the instant Riggs and Murtaugh are even within a mile of something that is tangentially related to their scheme, they're like, kill those cops immediately, and that's what escalates things. If they had just left well enough alone, Riggs and Murtaugh would probably fuck it up, because that's the running joke of the first few Lethal Weapons, is that those guys keep, like, especially the beginning of Lethal Weapon 3, where they accidentally blow up a building. You don't have to kill them. They'll fuck up on their own. Stop, like, getting in the crosshairs of the entire LAPD by trying to kill Riggs or threaten Murtaugh's family. Like, what the fuck are you doing? Who taught you how to be a villain?
Well, Brian, you...
I'm just saying.
Are you okay over there?
I'm just saying.
You're getting a little worked up, my friend.
Look, I think that there is a textbook that all villains need to read.
Look, Otto, I'm just saying.
What was the middle part of my argument? I don't even remember. One interesting thing about this movie is that Michael Palin, apparently, there were a few people who took issue with his performance and his stutter, and they thought maybe he was poking fun at people with stutters. But what's interesting about the way Michael Palin plays that stutter is he had firsthand experience. His father had a stutter. And if you notice in the movie, it's not constant. It's not the same stutter at every moment. It is exaggerated, and it's worse when he's around people he doesn't know or people he doesn't trust.
Yeah, when he's around Otto, under stress.
Yeah, when he's around Otto and he's under stress, it is severe. But if he's just talking to Wanda or George, it's pretty manageable. And, you know, there are things he can do to kind of make it better. And there's a firsthand knowledge of what a stutter actually is and how it works. And I feel like that got lost in a lot of people. It actually drove Michael Palin. He felt so guilty about it. He founded the London Center for Stammering Children because he felt so bad after a group of people had kind of questioned whether his...
Is that an offshoot of the Institute for Children Who Don't Read So Good?
The Derek Zoolander Institute for Kids Who Don't Read Good?
Yeah.
Yes. But it's nestled right between the Charles Xavier School for Gifted Stammering Children. You're going to be an X-Men, and your power will be that you can never finish a sentence. Whoa, wait. Actually, you know what? That's not a good power. Get over there with Jubilee and Dazzler. I don't know what the fuck they do.
Oh, no. You do not talk shit about Dazzler in this house.
I know. See, I figure if I'm going to get hot under the collar about Lethal Weapon villains, I can at least get you on that level by poking at
no.
This weird thing you have about Dazzler. You are super into Dazzler.
Dazzler's a cool fucking character that has a very interesting history and could have been even cooler.
If Disco hadn't lasted only a few years.
Yeah. Well, no, actually, no. As I've talked about publicly before, there's a whole history with
publicly, Dazzler. So it's on record. He's not making this up.
No. What I'm saying is, several people listening to the podcast have heard me talk about this before. But Dazzler was supposed to be black. She was supposed to be based on Diana Ross. She was going to be the Diana Ross mutant, and because of the way comics were at the time and the editors. They wanted her to be an attractive white woman that was more in the vein of someone like, I'm blanking on her name from Greece. Olivia Newton-John. And so she's this disco star whose power is she can turn sound into light. And so she takes loud noises and converts them into light and can turn them into lasers. And so she can do all sorts of crazy cool stuff with light right down to actually doing damage and such. But yeah, she was supposed to be based on Diana, kind of a cross between Diana Ross and Grace Jones, and the early designs for her are really fucking badass. And they were just like, yeah, no, we want another white character.
Well, you do realize that gives her all the superhuman abilities of a pile of cocaine, turning sound into light and lasers. Like, yeah, no, they did that a lot in the 70s.
No, because one of the other powers of cocaine is the ability to create the Lethal Weapon series.
This is true. This is very the ability to have a sterling career as a producer. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah, his name.
Really? Is that all you're going to say? Because you kind of want to do the impression. Mm-mm. You really
you know
want
to. It's a new era for this podcast.
Stargrove.
It's a new era for this podcast, and I don't want to keep falling back on all the old tricks. I mean, you were...
Hey, Joel Silver, are you here?
Fuck you for trying to get rid of me. You can't get rid of me. I own this place. I'll own you. I'll own you. I'll own all of those three dogs, dead or alive. I don't care. I'm Joel Silver. Fuck, Cargill. I tried really hard. I mean, you were the first one to say, like, let's get away from doing all of the .com gags. I mean, this is a new era for the show.
Well, I just felt the .com gag wasn't going to be funny anymore. But
Joel Silver, .com. Can't fucking get away from that either.
.com.
Damn it! And we're Joel Silver's lawsuit against us. .com. Oh, so Fish Called Wanda. I mean, it culminates into, you know, the airport chase. I mean, not terribly dissimilar from the airport chase of Midnight Run, and then we end up where John Cleese is on the plane with Jamie Lee Curtis. They have the diamonds, and who should pop up on the fucking wing of the plane like the gremlin from the Twilight Zone movie?
Yeah.
Kevin Kline for his last one.
They can't have one moment together without Kevin Kline showing up in a window.
To put a bow on not only that running joke, but then, of course, as the plane takes off and he's whisked off the wing for one last asshole!
I actually, my favorite moment from that entire sequence is actually just how startling it is what airport security was still like in the 80s.
Right?
Where you could actually, do that thing with the gun. Like,
oh, yeah, there's moment where Kevin Kline walks through the metal detector, wraps his wrist around the outside, flips his gun up to himself so that by the time he crosses the metal detector, he can catch the gun and it won't have gone through with him.
And tuck it in, and you could, that was doable. That was a thing you could do at the time. Security was so unbelievably lax. It's so weird to live in such a radically different world.
Dude, I'm telling
we
you.
We live in a RoboCop future that we were promised, except we don't get the cool cyborgs.
No, but we are about two steps away from the fucking Cobra flags flying at the White House. So, yeah, it is a very 80s future.
Cobra!
We should brand more things. It's about brand recognition. which, you know, I've been noticing
Cobra's like evil plan is to import, put tariffs on imports to help out you know, the Cobra's allies in the business world.
Well, at the expense of pissing off the one guy on our iTunes reviews who thinks we're too political because he's a fucking moron. I will say,
you know, it's people do listen to this for movies and not for us to condescend to them about our politics.
No, but what would be a great joke would be Cobra Commander going, and we're going to tariff everything and take over monuments and take children away from their parents. That's too fucking hardcore, man. Fuck that. There is something to the effect of, like, so many movie villains that we have talked about would be like, dude, I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole. Fuck that. Like, I'm a bad guy. Don't get me wrong. I'm not a monster.
I think we get a little too political, Brian.
Well, you know what? Go to iTunes and cry about it. Anywho, I think that brings us nicely to the... No. Before we get to the junk food pairing, I want to piggyback off something you said, because I've been noticing this a lot in movies as well recently, about the differences. Like, we just talked about Midnight Run, and that would probably be a climax you couldn't do in the post 9/11 airport era. As well as, I just watched, have you ever seen The Rookie? Clint Eastwood and Charlie Sheen?
Yeah, of course. I saw that in the theater.
Yeah, it's garbage, but there's...
It's got one of the weirdest, most deranged, wrong-headed seduction interrogation scenes I've ever seen.
Oh, it's a rape. Clint Eastwood gets raped in that movie, and it's so fucking... Why? I don't know. But what really... Like, the thing I can't forgive about that movie is how much they waste Raul Julia, and even Street Fighter didn't waste Raul Julia.
A lot of movies wasted Raul Julia.
You know, but I will say it again, Street Fighter did a better job utilizing Raul Julia than The Rookie did, and because I got so excited, I'm like, oh my god, Raul Julia's the bad guy, this is gonna be great, and then he's... anyway, but the climax of that movie is Raul Julia and the woman who rapes Clint Eastwood are running through first the runway, then the baggage claim, then into the airport with automatic weapons, and no one tries to take them out. Like, there's apparently no security at this airport whatsoever.
At Heathrow Airport. By the way, now, dear God, the security at Heathrow Airport makes America look lax. Like, I've had to fly through Heathrow.
You mean
times.
LAX makes America just look like all the airports are LAX?
Well, no, because LAX has
lax. I was making a joke about the word lax. I wasn't actually asking you how the security is at LAX.
I mean, because every time I'm at LAX, it's the Keystone fucking cops. Like, I get the B security team who always do something mostly incompetent. One time I had They had to run it through a separate machine, and the machine was too low, and so I had unzipped my bag, and I have a checkpoint friendly bag, and they go and put this bag in this. It has to be in the bin, and the woman says, you need to take it out because this will get caught, and then starts banging my laptop on the side of the bin, going, see, it will be caught, and I'm like, no. The laptop to display how it would bang the laptop. Oh my god, please.
What the fuck?
Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's the worst case that I've had, but I've had so many just like dunderheaded, like, these are the, I'm in the separate side room with the trainees, and anyone who's flown through LAX might know, oh shit, I've been at that side room. But like, Heathrow now is just, it's there's a whole automated system you have to go through first. And then you go through this, you know, this long, very invasive thing. Last time we went through, they threw out half of my wife's makeup because they had recently changed the standards on what qualified for the bag. And so she had to get rid of just half of her stuff. And she still, anytime we mention airport security, that comes up. And
well,
that's
don't buy her
points.
The Joel Silver line of cosmetics anymore. I think that might have been part of the problem. I mean, probably more troubling is the anal probes. I'm not sure why.
My wife said she wanted to powder her nose. How was I supposed to know that?
Good joke. And that brings us to the junk food pairing, which I think is probably the easiest we've ever done. It's fish and chips.
We say that sometimes, but yeah, it's fish and chips.
It's fish and chips. Ken is, you know...
Ken?
Ken has the french fries stuffed up his nose, and Otto makes a special point about how the English... They had one great contribution to world cuisine, and it was the chip. And what goes great with chips? It's the whole setup into him eating all the fish. So absolutely, absolutely fish and chips. And I have to apologize to the two wonderful volunteers at our screening last night who we did a trivia challenge for movie passes, and every time they got a question wrong, they had to stick a French fry up their nose.
So you asked the hardest questions known to man.
They weren't that hard. I feel like what was the name of the spiritual sequel to Fish Called Wanda is not a terribly hard question. Although, I don't know that I've ever seen Fierce Creatures.
It's not great.
I own it. I've owned it for years, and I think I bought it thinking it was this movie, like when I was in college. I thought it was this movie, so I bought the DVD for dirt cheap. I've never actually watched it.
I remember it when it came out, and everyone was like, oh, it's not A Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah. It does feature about 80% of the cast and crew from Fish Called Wanda, which is impressive, considering it's not connected to Fish Called Wanda narratively in any way, shape, or form. But speaking of things that don't conform to narrative in any way, shape, or form, Junk Food Cinema! You can find our entire back catalog on Blog Talk Radio and iTunes, where you can go and hate on us for being a couple of libtards. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/ You guessed the Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean really like the show.
If you like the show more than Kevin Klein loves killing people, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and throw a couple shekels into the hat. Guys, I want to thank you so much for all the support you've given us there. It's really... I can't tell you how much it's helped. And I also want to mention that this week at Convergence in Minneapolis, we'll be doing a live show. And I haven't said this publicly. I didn't know if... it was public knowledge, but I'll kind of be flying solo on that live show.
I won't be going because of the intense travel that I've had the last few months and the fact that I'm going back to London for the Arthur C. Clarke Award in just like a week and a half. So I was like, if I came back from Cinepocalypse, spent 4 days at home, and then flew to Minneapolis for a week, and then flew back for 2 days, and then flew to London... it would just kill me. I've been in half a dozen cities in the last month and a half. And
you should take a breather for sure.
I kind of need to enjoy this new house I bought. I kind of like it. It's pretty sweet.
Oh, I've been enjoying it a lot since you've been away. You might notice a few things are rearranged. There's a distinct scrotum smell on some of your throw pillows. It's been great that you've been traveling so much. That's all I'm going to say. But as much as I will definitely miss Cargill on that show, Harris O'Malley, a.k.a. Dr. Nerdlove, will be filling in as my co-pilot. And we will be talking about Blade, which will be experiencing its 20th anniversary this year, which is fucking nuts to think about. So definitely that's on Saturday at 5:00. So if you're going to Convergence, definitely make sure to check that out. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massawyrm, MassaWyrm. And you can find my new book, We're Where the Nightmares Go, in wherever you buy books, including audio. In both the UK and the US now. And Sea of Rust, of course, my Arthur C. Clarke shortlisted novel is available also wherever you buy books.
And you can actually pick that up at Heathrow Airport while all of your cavities are being searched. So that's a great way to kill some time there. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. I just want to mention again at Junk Food Cinema on Twitter. I've been having some really great conversations with the Junkions there. A lot of we played a game actually on Friday where you guys threw out movies and I threw out the perfect movie for a double feature. That was a lot of fun. It's been great interacting with you guys. So definitely follow us there.
I think the best way to close out this episode would be to say goodbye, Wanda.